At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Inflation, cows, and the economics of the human wrist. Questions? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 29th of October. Good to have you with us. And here is what we're going to do today, if it's all right with you. We are going to talk about the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee, the FOMC, for those in the know. It's meeting today and tomorrow to talk interest rates. And I don't need to tell you, it's been a rocky couple of weeks since the Fed's last meeting, the shutdown, the debt ceiling, say no more. So nobody is expecting any big changes in policy. Chairman Bernanke and the gang will probably keep on buying bonds, putting money into the economy, while at the same time keeping a close eye on inflation. Y'all remember inflation, right? Marketplace's David Gura explains why a little bit of it right now might be a good thing.
It's a word that for most of us does not have positive connotations. I say inflation, and maybe you think of high gas prices or high interest rates. Anne Owen is an economics professor at Hamilton College.
The type of concerns that people have about inflation are usually associated with inflation that's unpredictable and inflation that's moving around quite a bit.
What the Fed wants is some inflation, so long as it's fairly moderate and stable.
That gives businesses some room to raise the prices on their products.
Kevin Jakes teaches finance at Baldwin Wallace University.
That gives prices on real assets the opportunity to go up, which would make, for example, consumers feel wealthier because their homes are now worth more.
Moderate inflation can also help the labor market. Hamilton's Anne Owen says that's because companies dealing with inflation may be able to hire more workers.
So if you are making $10 an hour and inflation goes up a little bit, the value of what the employer is paying you is a little bit less.
The Fed said it wants inflation to be right around 2%. Now, that's lower than the historical average, which is about 3%. Owen says when it comes to managing inflation, policymakers have a tricky job.
The concern is that once you get inflation accelerating, that momentum is going to keep it going beyond where they want it to be.
Which could lead to those high gas prices and high interest rates. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Hey, so listen, I tried calling, but you never picked up. No voicemail, no nothing. And here's the thing. I was calling your landline. Here's the other thing. You're the fire department and my house is on fire. That is the worst case scenario for a problem that's been getting worse in recent years across parts of rural America. A lot of telephone calls just aren't going through at all. Marketplace's Dan Weissman reports the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, has been looking into things.
First question here is, huh? Really? Rebecca Goodhart is a lawyer for the FCC, and she's right there with the rest of us on this.
You can call across the world. You can use your computer for anything. But yeah, actually calling to rural areas has become an increasingly difficult problem.
And a serious one. This isn't just Ma and Pa Kent not hearing from Clark when he flies off to Metropolis. Goodhart says she's seen a case where a hospital couldn't reach the doctor on call. How'd we get here? The answer starts about 100 years ago, when AT&T, then affectionately known as Ma Bell, undertook to connect the whole country with long-distance wires.
Well, Ma Bell didn't exactly get out to everywhere.
That's Michael Romano, Vice President for Policy at the National Telecommunications Cooperative Association. They represent about 900 local companies serving the areas Ma Bell never got to. Back in the day, Ma Bell would take the call to the virtual doorstep of one of those companies, a switch someplace at the edge of town, and a local carrier would take it from there. These days, your phone company, like Verizon, hands it off to a third-party company. They're a bunch, and whichever is offering the best deal probably picks up the call. And then they look for the cheapest way to route the call, which could bounce it around a bunch of networks.
So the call from Chicago might go through Minneapolis and route around through eastern South Dakota to western, or it might go out to Denver and then come back.
And every time the call gets bounced, it can get dropped. This week's FCC rules require providers to keep track of how many calls actually go through to rural areas and report back. It won't fix the problem, but at least it'll help identify exactly where things are going wrong. I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, stocks were up. There was a data glitch on the NASDAQ. And oh, by the way, this is the 84th anniversary of the start of the Great Depression. Otherwise, nothing much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Since the Syrian civil war started more than 2 years ago, millions of Syrians have left home. They've gone to refugee camps in Turkey and then in Lebanon and Jordan. And increasingly, they're winding up in Europe. The BBC's Matthew Price followed one family to Vienna.
It's 9 o'clock in the morning on a cold, gray day here in Vienna. And the night train from Italy has just arrived. Getting off it is a family from Syria. I'm now with the family in a nearby cafe. The children, as you'd imagine, are tired, they're hungry. The little boy's just fallen asleep on the bench here. Mum and Dad, who seem to be in their mid-40s, they look nervous, shaken, they're chain-smoking. They do still have relatives in Syria, so they've asked me not to reveal their identity.
I want a better life and stability for my children. I want them to go to school and live just like other kids. The children are living in fear. They ask me, "Where's our house, Mom?" My daughter asks me about her bed. She wants to sleep in her bed, and I don't know what to say to her.
The teenage daughter is sitting staring blank-eyed out of the cafe window onto what for her is an alien land, a Viennese shopping street. Just imagine what this family is currently going through. They're on the move. They have no security, no language to help them here. It's a cold, grey city, a far cry from the tiny, dusty Italian island of Lampedusa where I first met them at the refugee centre a few days ago. Sitting in the heat under the pine trees, she told me the boat journey had been a suicide trip. We almost died, she said. They'd left Syria a year earlier, flying from Aleppo to Cairo. Then they were smuggled across the border to Libya, where they hoped to stay. But growing instability there persuaded them to take a boat to Lampedusa. Italian officials transferred them to another refugee centre in southern Italy. Once there, they were actively encouraged to leave the country.
The Red Cross took us by car to the train station. Someone from the refugee camp helped us book the tickets, and we took the train to Vienna.
So finally they've decided to leave the cafe. They're going to take a tram to the asylum centre on the outskirts of town. They've got one suitcase between them, everything that they brought with them. And the little girl is shivering under a blanket draped around her shoulders.
This is injustice. If those politicians just go and see how the Syrians live in their country, they would decide to take them from there without having to follow illegal ways to get here. I don't blame the European countries, I blame the Arab countries, who refuse to accept us and don't allow us to enter their soil.
What do you want for them if you can stay here in Austria? What sort of life do you want for the children?
I want a better life for them, and I want them to be happy. I want them to smile again. They are clever, and I wish they could go to school and live their lives just like other kids. My only concern is my children, not me, and not my husband.
Their journey continued along quiet residential streets as the sun dropped lower in the hazy autumn sky. The little boy kicked up leaves on the pavement, and that evening they formally applied for asylum in Austria.
Matthew Price from the BBC. We talked barges yesterday, Austin Golding out in Vicksburg, Mississippi, in our continuing quest to explore, you know, the actual economy that people live in. Today, it's beef, cows, and rancher Ken Lennox in Rolla, Missouri. Mr. Lennox, it's good to talk to you again, sir.
Yes, sir. Good to talk to you.
It's been a while since we've had you on, and I guess the first thing is, how are things going? How are the cattle? How's the herd?
Well, the cattle are doing great. The cows are about through calving. We've had maybe 325 new babies in the last 8 weeks. So
wow.
Everything's been pretty successful this fall.
What's it like when you have 325 new baby cows to deal with?
Well, you spend a lot of time looking at them and trying to make sure that the mamas and the babies are paired up right and nothing bothers them.
What's the plan then? You're going to fatten these guys up and sell them off, or what do you do with them?
We leave them on their mothers for 8-9 months, and then we sell them through the auctions. The steers will be weighing 650 pounds, and all of that's on mother's milk and grass, so
wow.
There's no grain or anything like that comes into them.
When you sell them off, how are you doing? Are you getting good prices? What's the market like?
The market's been good. The heifers are strong, replacement heifers going back into other people's herds, and I usually save most of my good heifers back. I keep about half and sell about half, so That's going well, too.
This is going to be a completely silly question, but do you ever get attached to these cows? I mean, you birth most of them right there, and you see them their whole lives?
No. No, that doesn't occur on this farm. You know, they're part of the family more or less, but when the time comes to go.
I was reading the other day, Mr. Lennox, that herd sizes are down sort of across the country. Are you seeing that? Is your herd smaller now than it used to be?
No, mine's not. But yeah, they are down. Every state, they're down. Now, there are all kinds of reasons for that. The South, the droughts come into play. The high price of corn, taking care of your feedings, come into play. The age of the people that own the ranches comes into play.
Hmm.
So, yeah, the herd's down, but it could be on starting to turn around from the factors I see.
Not that this is any of my business, Mr. Lennox, but how old are you, sir?
I turned 70 this year, so I'm not going to expand very much.
Well, but how much longer are you going to be doing it?
Probably as my health stays good, I enjoy doing it. It's still, when I get out every morning, I walk out of the house before the sun's up by 30 minutes or so. And it's a new day, and I look forward to what's going on in that day.
And then by the end of the day, you're still a happy man?
I'm still happy with what went on that day.
Ken Lennox, he's our cattle rancher out in Rolla, Missouri. Mr. Lennox, thanks very much, sir. We'll check in with you soon.
Okay, thank you.
Coming up. They really live dual lives, and then you put them in the suit, and it's like a Batman or Superman suit. It transforms them.
Sports mascots, I kid you not. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 111 points today, almost 0.75%, closed at 15,680. The NASDAQ rose 12 points, 0.3%, 3952. The S&P 500 gained 9 points, that's about 0.5%, 1771 there. The Dow and the S&P, by the way, record highs. Big Blue and Big Pharma gave the blue chips a shot in the arm. You like what I did right there? IBM said it would buy back up to $15 billion worth of its shares. That is to boost the stock price. And today alone, IBM picked up 2.75%. Look at that. Pfizer rose 1.75%. Today, a strong sales of new cancer drugs helped produce better-than-expected profits. Sales at Sears declined, but investors cheered the possibility the company might spin off its Sears Auto Center and Lands End units. Shares up nearly 12% today, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. The Federal Reserve wraps a two-day meeting on interest rates. The Labor Department issues its Consumer Price Index for September. And the Census Bureau says there were 115 million occupied housing units across the country in 2011. If you're represented in that figure, you are a potential stop for trick-or-treaters. So stock up on candy. That is one basket of goods you don't want to be without. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Consider for a moment the human wrist, a marvel of biomechanical engineering, also apparently an amazingly lucrative piece of anatomy. Google is said to be working on a smartwatch. Samsung put out its Galaxy Gear watch a couple of weeks ago. There's a Sony smartwatch on the market, and Apple probably has a watch coming, too. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports now on the wrist wars.
Tara Kalashain is the editor of tech website Research Buzz, but when it comes to new devices, she's not usually an early adopter.
But with the smartwatches, I'm like, y'all, hurry up. I want to see these things.
The reason?
I love the idea of when I get an email alert to be able to see it on my wrist without having, you know, to take out my phone, unlock my screen.
That ease of use is behind the growing market for wearable technology, says Sarah Rotman, senior analyst at Forrester Research.
The body is the next landscape for personal computing.
And the wrist is the first frontier. Forrester found nearly a third of adults would wear a device on their wrist. Only 12% were comfortable wearing something like Google's glasses. But comfortable may not be enough.
As a woman, I can say, if it weren't my job to wear these products, I would never do it.
Right now, smartwatches look a lot like those watches from the 80s that had little calculators on them, which is a huge problem, says Deborah Kay, head of consulting firm Lucule.
Something that we put on our bodies is part of our status. It's part of who we are.
Which means once tech companies get smartwatches right, the payoff could be huge.
The wrist is like the holy grail for wearable technology. If you can get something on the wrist, you can really own a person's body.
Kay says the technology becomes part of our identity, not just something we carry around. So the future of tech really is all in the wrist. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
It's getting chilly or downright cold in parts of the rest of the country. Here in Southern California, though, we're still smack in the middle of wildfire season. It's been a busy one so far. Nearly 40% more fires out there than usual, which means firefighters have been using more fire retardant, that orange liquid you see sometimes being dropped from planes. From KPCC here in Los Angeles, Sandon Totten reports that sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Up close, retardant looks like carrot juice.
This is fire retardant here. This is was mixed this summer.
Kevin Reed works for the state agency CAL FIRE. He says it's orange so firefighters can see it from the air. And he insists it's totally safe to touch, which is good because he just poured it all over my hand.
Ugh, it kind of does feel like snot. I feel like I just got slimed in Ghostbusters.
Yeah, it's Ghostbusters. It's just a different color.
We're at a CAL FIRE air base in Hemet. This is where tanker planes fill up on retardant before flying out to the front lines. Kevin Reed fires up the machine that mixes powdered retardant with water to make that signature orange slime.
So, and that's how your retardant mixes, right there.
All the retardant in the U.S. is made in Southern California by one company, Foscheck. George Matusik works there.
So I'm going to take my lighter here.
He's holding a sheet of paper towel. Half of it is normal. The other half was dipped in retardant and then dried.
And I'll light the untreated end. You can see, as soon as it got to the retardant, it turned black, but it went out.
He says retardant is mostly ammonium phosphate, basically a fertilizer. When a fire gets near the stuff, it creates a reaction that turns woody material into an almost pure form of carbon. Matusik says that takes away the fire's fuel source.
If you think of a diamond or graphite, neither one of those will burn. That's pure carbon. And if this was a tree, it'd be black on the outside, but alive on the inside.
Small-scale demonstrations like this are one thing. But Andy Stahl says in the real world, dropping fire retardant can have serious consequences. He's with a watchdog group called the Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics.
Dump a load of retardant in a creek. You can kill the fish for miles downstream. It literally kills the fish within minutes.
That happened in 2009. Retardant killed dozens of endangered fish in Santa Barbara County. It was an accident. Firefighters normally won't drop within 300 feet of a waterway. But Stahl says, even with that rule in place, retardant isn't worth the risk, since he claims there's no statistical evidence the stuff reliably helps in the field.
We can find individual anecdotal examples where, yes, it appears that in this one place, we dropped the retardant and the fire stopped.
But he says for every case like that, there are 10 where the retardant didn't seem to help at all.
I mean, every time you drop fire retardant, there's so many variables.
Glenn Stein works with the U.S. Forest Service, where he studies retardant.
You know, whether it's the temperature or the humidity or the wind. And so you're never quite sure whether it was the fire retardant that did it or whether it was some other variable that did it.
But Stein says there are hundreds of laboratory tests showing retardant slows fires in controlled settings. The Forest Service can spend up to $36 million a year on its retardant program. But that's only around 4% of their total firefighting budget. Cal Fire's Kevin Reed says the orange slime is totally worth it. But dropping it is just the first step.
We deliver the retardant, and then the ground crews have to do their part on the ground to actually put the fire out.
And Reed says the more tactics you can use to put out a fire, the better. In Hemet, California, I'm Sandon Totten for Marketplace.
Professional basketball season starts tonight. Lots of on-court action, to be sure. But take a minute when you're not actually watching the ball and have a look at the sidelines. At the 7-foot-tall, quite possibly furry mascot, doing its best to get the crowd riled up and into the game. And then think about the person inside, about what their life might be like. The life of a sports mascot is the subject of a new series that's starting today on Hulu. It's called Behind the Mask. Josh Greenbaum is the creator and director. Josh, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
This is amazingly gripping television, I have to tell you.
Wow. Thank you.
But it's because I didn't really think it would be, is the thing. I mean, it's about mascots, for crying out loud. First of all, how did you come up with the idea?
It's just been something that's been kind of cooking in my head for years. Ever since I was little and I was at sporting events, I sort of saw those guys. You know, instead of watching the game, I saw the kind of giant furry character off to the side.
Yeah.
And as I got older, I started wondering, you know, who's inside the suit? And then really, as I became a filmmaker, I started asking why. And that's really what this show looks at, is why is someone choose this profession in this world?
I'll tell you what, it's the character arcs just in the first half-hour episode were kind of amazing. I mean, I'm not going to give anything away here, but this high school kid who is introverted and awkward, and you put him in that costume from the Lebanon High School in Pennsylvania, and he goes bananas.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's part of what I was so intrigued by is the sort of superhero parallel.
Right, exactly.
They really live dual lives. And what you'll often see in many of these characters, I'd say two of the four that we follow are, as you said, incredibly introverted. And then you put them in the suit, and it's like a Batman or Superman suit. It transforms them.
Tell me about the search. We should say there are four main characters, right? A high school kid, a college guy, a semi-pro hockey mascot and a pro basketball mascot. How did you find these four people? You must have talked to a zillion mascots.
We did. I had a whole team helping me out, and we reached out to literally thousands of potential candidates to follow. And it was quite a difficult search because these mascots actually abide by a pretty serious code, and chief among those rules is not revealing their true identity. So I would say, especially at the pro level, about 90 to 95% of them came back and said, thanks, but no thanks. I'm not willing to let you show me outside of the suit and reveal who I am. They said, you can blur my face. You can change my voice. And I said, oh, you know, that's great, but I don't think we can do a 10-episode, 30-minute docuseries about you with a sort of blacked-out face. Or
can these guys make a living doing this?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, you talked about our NBA pro. Yeah. You know, these guys often make six figures and up. So, yeah, when they get good at it.
Of course,
when
he's jumping off a 40-foot ladder to do it.
That's right.
There is, as well, a career progression for these guys. I mean, you can go from a college mascot job to a semi-pro hockey mascot job. And then this guy who does it for the Wilkes-Barre, what are they, the Penguins or whatever, right?
That's right.
The
hockey team, yeah.
He keeps talking about wanting to make it to the NHL.
Yeah.
He's like, I will not give up. I've been doing this 10 years, and I'm going to get there, and I'm going to make it to the NHL. And it's like he's actually playing, except he's inside a Penguin costume.
That's right. Yeah, and he'll talk to you about how difficult a move it is. I mean, you think there's only one per team, and actually several teams don't have a mascot. And when these guys get these jobs, they keep them for 15, 20 years. So there's maybe one opening in the pros every few years.
Sort of like public radio, actually.
That's right.
Which is a whole different documentary, I guess. You're a young guy. So maybe this question, I don't know how you'll answer this question, but it sort of seems like this is the golden age for people who want to do this kind of television because you have so many outlets. You could have gone to HBO. You could have gone to Netflix. You could have gone to all over the place.
Yeah, it is. I mean, as I said, I do think it's the golden age of television and just content creation. And I think what's so exciting for me with Hulu is that, you know, when somebody watches this show, like I think you did, you could send a link out instantly and say to your friends, check this out, and they can watch it. And that's exciting for me as a creator just because there's sort of instantly it can spread. You know, you always talk about starting a small fire and hoping that it spreads. It's really easy to do that on a channel like Hulu.
Josh Greenbaum, his film, his docuseries, if you will, on Hulu is called Behind the Mask. Josh, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me, Kai.
I meant it when I said this is gripping television. The first three episodes are up on Hulu right now. They're going to release the rest of them one at a time on Tuesdays.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, of which I confess I know not what to make. Today is National Cat Day, which, first of all right. More importantly, though, to mark the occasion, the private car service Uber has been doing something special. For $20. They will bring you a cat and cupcakes for some reason, too. But you get 15 minutes of kitten time for your $20. Proceeds to your local cat shelter, which is a good cause. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Nancy Fargali, John Ketchum, and Jolie Myers are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.